Good to see everyone is out tonight. We're going to go back and, as you can tell on the board, we're going to continue to talk about the Jehovah's Witnesses. And we're going to tonight go ahead with the story, the background story, the history, or whatever. Although, as I said last week, and this will be true, as we get to the latter part of the lesson, it will get into more doctrinal and so forth. And then, obviously, next Sunday evening, we'll have the fifth Sunday singing. And just to give you an idea of where we're going, then in the next lesson, and probably two, we'll spend one lesson focusing primarily on the real doctrinal aspects of what the witnesses believe, and another lesson trying to sort of clear it up from the Word of God. And all that will become clear as we get into it. But as we continue to look at the history, remember when we last left, we were dealing with this long, long presidency from Judge Rutherford. If you remember, one of the things that I emphasized last time and will again tonight, if you're going to understand the Jehovah's Witnesses, as different from the Mormons, really, and for that matter, as different from the Muslim religion that we'll go into next, really this one stands alone in that if you're going to understand the cult, you have to understand that it is a cult based more on a doctrine than a man. I hope we get to it. We get into the latter part of the history tonight. You'll see really that less and less whoever is in the position of so-called being the head of this, some would say denomination, but this cult is less important than the doctrines behind it. And we'll see that more and more as we get into it tonight. Also, we said this, there are charismatic leaders, and especially there were at the beginning of the movement, but again, it is that particular doctrine that drives or is the engine of the movement, drives the movement, etc. So let's, again, talk about the history. The next guy that took over the presidency was a man by the name of Nathan Knorr. And while his name is not all that important, some of the things that he did during his tenure are very important. He was born in 1905, and obviously, you're kind of moving ahead from the 1800s now, clearly well into the 1900s, mid-century. But he joined the Witnesses about 1923, became a volunteer at the Watchtower headquarters over here in Brooklyn shortly after, and was elected as the third president of the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society in 1942, so right in the middle of World War II. And I might add, as we get into looking at some of that at the end of the lesson, right in a very tumultuous time for the Witnesses. Judge Russell died, and he became the president. And that is a picture of Mr. Knorr. Maybe I'll go back and let you look at him a little bit. There's a picture of Mr. Knorr. All right. Now let's talk about his presidency for a little bit. Made significant contributions to the Witnesses, and if you'll notice, I said providing a heavy educational focus. This will be where the Witnesses become, and if you remember how they started, they were Bible students, if you remember that. And they will go more from being students to being Witnesses. Remember, their name changed in the previous administration to Jehovah's Witnesses. And in every aspect now, they will be Witnesses. And that will be what they do. And so there's less of a focus on study. They study their material, but less certainly of a focus on study of the Bible and more on a teaching. So when it says heavy educational focus, understand that it is an educational focus with an idea or an intent to teach the doctrine. So within a month of taking office, he had an agenda, obviously, when he came in. He established a school that featured Bible research, but don't let that kid you. It really was not so much Bible research, and we'll emphasize that all through the rest of the discussion of the Witnesses. It's really researching the Bible and particular prophecies that relate to that main doctrine, again, that is driving the cult. But Bible research and public speaking. He developed what he called an advanced course in theocratic ministry, and he authored a number of textbooks and instituted those. He also moved for the establishment of what's called the Gilead School in 1943, and this was specifically to train missionaries. And this began a real thrust into really foreign countries all over the world. it may or may not surprise you, but if you were to go into, for example, Oriental countries, even some Oriental countries that it's hard to get into and teach, you find thriving Jehovah's Witness communities. Very strange. A lot of the Slavic countries are driven, I mean, very extremely hard aspects of the Jehovah's Witness movement. Very conservative, I guess they would call it. But it's very interesting to notice how this movement has gone all over the world. Well, again, in Noor's time, right in the middle of World War II, he was training missionaries and sending them into all the world. There was an explosive growth in a number of countries around the world. We'll show that in a moment. He also developed what he called their smoothness of presentation. Now, I'll slow down for a moment here, and if you think about it, this is very similar to the Jehovah's Witness, to the Mormons' practice. Get the presentation down, and please pardon this, but it is the truth. Assume up front that people are stupid, and cults really thrive upon that idea. People are stupid, and keep it simple, stupid. You know, I'm sure everybody's heard of that, the whole KISS movement. Keep it simple, stupid. Get the presentation down to a very polished, a lot of pictures, a lot of color, a lot of flash, a lot of glitz. Get it smooth, present it. People won't really think, they'll just kind of be mindless and follow along. And that he developed for the Jehovah's Witnesses the same thing that the Mormons at the time in the 40s and 50s were starting to have tremendous success. All of this with the elders movement, everything you see. Well, the Jehovah's Witnesses sent out not their elders, but their pioneers. We're going to see that in just a moment. They sent out their pioneers and they had a very smooth presentation and it worked. No question about it. He also instituted what he called a circuit servant. This would be a person who traveled around, as you can see, among congregations, helping them to improve their effectiveness. So it all became a very well-oiled machine and smooth, emphasis on smoothness. And people, and that's the whole point, brainwash the people and you keep a cult really moving. He initiated a number of organizational changes as well, and these coincided, and it's interesting. Maybe one of the things you've got to give him credit for, and the movement credit for, well, let me not get ahead of myself, but I'll show you that in just a second. He did not try to be a dictator, whereas maybe Rutherford and Russell that preceded him, you might say they were. He didn't try to be, so to speak. So he instituted a number of organizational changes. In fact, there was a revision of the Watchtower Society's organization manual in 1972, and this would be right at the end of his time. But it stated, and I quote from the manual, "It is noteworthy," he says, "that the Bible does not say that there was only one older man, elder, one overseer in each congregation. Rather, it indicates that there were a number of such." Now, you see what he's doing effectively, and this is interesting to me. What he's doing is he's slowly taking away, even though he's initiated all of these very constructive changes, at least the movement would see them as such, he's really taking power away. Now, if I were a cynic, I might step back and say, well, the dude's old, and now that he's initiated all the changes, he wants those changes, even after he dies, he wants those changes to go on. If I were cynical, I might look at that. If I were trying to really give him a lot of benefit of the doubt, I might say, well, you know, this is really a step in the right direction. You're trying to take the control away from one man, even one man in one congregation. You're saying, rightly so. Just like, you know, we pointed out about the Mormons, they had baptism at least for the remission of sins. All the other stuff with it was wrong, but that part was right. Well, the idea of a plurality of elders and everybody having equal say as far as the eldership is concerned, that's right. With that understanding, there was, quote-unquote, a body of elders and ministerial servants. And all of these replaced that one single congregation servant or overseer that had become so prevalent in the previous administration, Judge Russell's administration. Or Rutherford, I think those guys mixed up, but nonetheless, had become so prevalent in their time. Now, one of the elders, he said, would be designated chairman, so that's a little bit of contradiction there. But they're all going to have equal authority. So one guy is serving as chairman, but they're all going to have equal authority in their decision-making. Of course, what does all of that mean? Well, you're going to see, that doesn't mean a whole lot right now, but you're going to see where this goes in just a moment. It is interesting where it went. In December of 1975, the real leadership then passed from the president himself of the Watchtower Society to what was now called the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses. And it's, for that matter, remains this, continues to be called this, right up until our present time. I'll show you the change at the end of the lesson if I get to it. But the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses, and this becomes the authority. So the president loses control, quote unquote, and the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses now gains it. And that happens in the 75. The chairman of the governing body, rather than being elected, would rotate. So that further takes any possibility of having a one-man show, because now everybody is serving in that capacity. You don't have the one guy elected chairman for life, but it just kind of rotates among all those elders. And that is an interesting concept to me, at least, that a cult would do that. But again, remember, this is a cult based not on a man, but on a doctrine. From New Year's 1976, and this is a little pun on my part here, they don't observe holidays, so I thought I'd throw one in. But from January the 1st, 1976, the governing body instituted several, what they call, committees. Now, these committees are really ruling bodies. Several committees to, quote, oversee publishing, writing, teaching, service, and personnel. So you can see how all of the oversight is passed from the president now to the body, to the committee, to the governing body. And this, of course, further reduced the power of the presidency in deference to the governing body of Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, that's not the most significant change. You might think it would be, but it's not. The most significant change during Nord's administration was the publication of their own Bible. I've got one up here. You may or may not have seen this. It's called the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures. During Knorr's tenure, and this took a long time. It went from the 40s to the 60s. But there was the publication of this Bible. Inaccurate, to be sure, and I'm going to show you a couple of examples in just a moment. Inaccurate, thus completely unreliable. Nonetheless, the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures, NWT as it's called, was published in 1961 by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. And the Society explained the need for a fresh translation. Now remember, we always said, and this is one thing that you'll find with cults, if they are well established, if they last for any length of time. I mean, if they're a flash in the pan, Jim Jones comes along. With Jim Jones, it was all about the man. It had nothing to do with a doctrine. It just was all about the man. There never was a formation of any scriptures. In fact, Jim Jones was famous, as I've told you many times, for taking a Bible, throwing it across the room, and saying, you don't need that anymore. Listen to me. But if a cult lasts for any length of time, it's got to live past the time of a man. And so there has to be, obviously, if you point people to the Bible and strictly get people back in the Bible, that's going to take them away from the cult. So there's got to be a publication of alternate scriptures. There has to be. And it will always be so. If you've got a cult, you've got alternate scriptures. And that's the same with the society. But here's their explanation of a need for the fresh translation. And those of you that are in our Wednesday night class, the adult class, some of what I'm about to talk to, we're going to discuss in that class. Not so much from the JW's point of view, but we're going to talk about some of this. Here's what they said. They primarily used the King James and American Standard versions of the Bible at the time. Again, you're thinking 40s and 50s. And they said most Bible versions employ archaic language. Thou shalt, ye, etc. And so it's outdated. Even the American Standard Version has a lot of that kind of thing, so it's outdated language. So they said there needed to be a modern, fresh translation. But that really wasn't the big point. Here was the big point. They said there was better manuscript evidence. In the time King James was translated, or at least published in 1611, and the American Standard was published in 1901. So since that time, archaeology being what it is, there was quite a discovery of manuscripts. Again, this is our Wednesday night class. We're going to get into manuscripts and all of that kind of thing and how it affects translations. But they said better manuscript evidence had made it possible to determine with greater accuracy what the original writers, and here's the important part of it, and I want you to look at it carefully, what the original writers intended. Okay? So you pick up a Bible, you read it, and what it seems to say what it looks as though it says, what you and I would say it says, they would say that's not what the Paul and Peter and so forth intended. And then if you notice, he says, or they say, particularly in more obscure passages. Now, I'm going to give you an example, not the ones you might think of as obscure, but I'll give you a couple of examples. And again, and there's a picture of that, New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures. You can't see mine real well. Hopefully you can see it. That's a picture of mine, as you can tell. But the New World Translation of the Holy Scriptures. Now, how is it alternate? Well, it really is. Because the basis of this translation came from a number of different sources, and I'm not going to cite them all here, a lot of the ones you would think of, the Hebrew, the Greek, etc. But it notably included this thing. And this is, as you can see on the front here, I'll show you a picture in a minute, the Diaglot. It notably included that, and it's interesting. Because if you're going to base it on manuscripts, up to the moment manuscripts, it's kind of funky that you go back and pull out a Greek text compilation or whatever that's already approaching 60 years old. Because there are a number of manuscripts that have been discovered since the time. But that's not really what they're interested in. And it shows you the real intent here. But the emphatic Diaglot, it was itself a so-called translation. Actually, what it was a Diaglot. And what that is a two-language translation. Literally what you get, any of you are welcome to look at this thing, what you get is the Greek text, underneath it, a supposed, and it really is horrible, but a supposed word-for-word literal translation, just as it reads in Greek, and then you get the English translation. Now, this thing was used almost verbatim in many passages for the New World Translation. This thing came out in 1864, about 100 years before, even with the publishing of the New World Translation, about 100 years before they actually published it. A good 75, 80 years before they started working on it. There's a picture of it. And it really is a major influence on the Bible of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, let's talk about this thing for just a moment. The Diaglot is notable for its use of the word Jehovah. Naturally, if you're calling yourself Jehovah's Witnesses, you want something that emphasizes the name Jehovah. Furthermore, if you believe that Jehovah is the only acceptable name, you really want something that uses the name Jehovah. But if you notice what I'm saying here, it's notable for its use of Jehovah even when the original text doesn't employ that name. Now, this is what I mean by that. Jehovah, or Yahweh, or Yahweh, or whatever, is a Hebrew name. And you can find it in a number of passages. It occurs in a number of passages. Genesis chapter 22, Jehovah Jireh, a name for God. But in a number of other passages, you know, and obviously the most famous would be Exodus 3. What name do I give them? Tell them I am has sent you. Jehovah or Yahweh. But if you look at Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. The name for God there is not Jehovah. It's Elohim or Elohim. And if you looked at Psalm 110, the word Lord that's so often translated in the Bible, Adonai, and a lot of you I'm sure have heard some of the popular newer Christian music and that kind of thing, and you hear the name Adonai. Well, there are different names for God, and that's what I'm getting at. And they mean different things. I am the self-consistent God, Elohim, the Almighty, the Powerful, the plural. God, as I emphasized a couple of weeks ago. Adonai, the Lord, the majestic God Almighty. But one of the things that they wanted to do was to emphasize the name Jehovah because they believe that is the name for God, and they are Jehovah's Witnesses. But if you'll notice, I've also got up here, and you're probably wondering, what is all of this about? It also, the Diaglot is also notable for its de-emphasis of the deity of Jesus. So they're Jehovah's Witnesses, and that is in deference to Jehovah over Jesus. Never misunderstand that. Because they de-emphasize the deity of Jesus. And we're going to talk a lot more about that. Let me give you an example. In Luke chapter 20 and verse 42, incidentally, this Diaglot is only New Testament. Okay? But obviously it's going to quote the Old Testament quite a bit. But in Luke 20 and verse 42, if you want to open your Bibles and look at that, in Luke 20, David is quoted there as saying, in Psalm 110, The passage that I tell you, and I've told you many times, is the most quoted Old Testament passage. Psalm 110, "The Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou at my right hand." And of course, that's where he tells him, "Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Well, when they translate it, they don't say the Lord. They don't say it so in Psalm, and they don't say so in the quotation of it in Luke 20, verse 42. Jehovah said to my Lord. Now, what does that do? Well, it's very slight, almost insignificant, and almost to the point that a person would say, well, it doesn't really matter. And I would agree with you. It doesn't matter all that much unless you understand what they're doing with it. The Father is Jehovah. The Father is God. Jesus is lesser. He is not Jehovah. Jehovah said to my Lord. Now, how do we know that? Well, look at John 1 and verse 1. Now, here's a quotation from the Diaglot, and I'm going to show you the only way it differs, and you can check it out for yourself if you want to look at this after the sermon. The only way it differs in the New World Translation. The Diaglot says, and if you've already read it, it says, "In the beginning was the Word." Now, obviously, this is Jesus. "In the beginning was the Word." Listen carefully. "And the Word was with the God, and a God was the Word." And it goes on to describe it like that. Now, if you look at the New World Translation, it almost says it literally word for word. It doesn't change the meaning at all. It says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with the God, and the Word was a God." Now, what you find when you look at passages in the New Testament that emphasize the deity or the eternity of Jesus, they're mistranslated. Horribly mistranslated. Just like this one is. Because it wants to show that there's a difference. That Jesus is not the eternal God. Remember back a couple of weeks ago I did a couple of lessons on the deity of Jesus and all of that kind of thing. When you deal with the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Mormons for that matter, but when you deal with the Jehovah's Witnesses especially, and we're going to talk more about this, but you deal with talking with people who do not believe in the deity of Jesus as you would believe in the deity of Jesus. So obviously it's very cultic. The New World Translation. After Wilson is the guy that put out the Diaglot. After his death in 1900, and this goes back to Charles Taze Russell's administration, basically what he's saying here is his heirs, if I can get the word out, inherited the copyright to the Diaglot, but the Jehovah's Witnesses under Russell quickly scooped that up. And since that time, all the editions of the Diaglot have been published by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. In fact, it's moved into public domain now. So if you want to, I suppose you could produce your own copy of the Diaglot. I don't know why in the world you want to do that, but nonetheless. But they took it over. And so it has become synonymous, really, with them. The New World Translation is widely used and distributed by the Jehovah's Witnesses. And to show you how widely distributed, as of 2010, current figures, there's about 165 million copies of this thing in 86 different languages in the world. So we are not talking about a small cult by any sense of the term. Under Norris' presidency, the society enjoyed its greatest growth. And I said that earlier. All of that pioneers, all of that smoothness of presentation. When he took over, there were 98,076 active members in 1942. By the time he left office, there were 2.25 million in 1977. Now, that is surprising, really, when we show in just a moment some of the other stuff that happened in Norris's time. You would think that people would be leaving the cult in droves. But as you can see here, they go from less than 100,000 to nearly 2.25 million. Even with all of the stuff I'm about to show you going on. And that's quite incredible. It all goes to say, maybe there is a whole lot to that smoothness of presentation idea. The doctrine of not accepting blood transfusion. While we might look at that as just something that's kind of ridiculous, at one time there was a real furor over this. Jehovah's Witnesses were known for this. I can remember being a young kid, not even knowing what the adults were talking about, but a couple of these people came to the door, knocked on the door in Hartsell, Alabama, and boy, there was a reaction. They were Jehovah's Witnesses. Man, what a reaction. And then, you know, this, and how people are talking. And people are talking, and they're talking about what these guys believe, what these people believe, and all of that kind of thing. And they were known for this. These are the people, strange people, you know, like some others who don't believe in certain things like blood transfusions or whatever. And if a person doesn't know a whole lot about the doctrine, the history, or whatever, they'll know things like this about them. But this came up and came about, or whatever you want to call it, was introduced during his time. He served as president until just before his death in 1977. I want you to hang on to that date, because I want to go back and talk about some things. I'm going to wait till I get to the guy, but I want to go back and talk about some things that happened at the end of his presidency. Remember, he has stepped back. Leadership has really been passed to a great deal, but this is a well-oiled machine now moving with this doctrine. And again, you would think it would be driving people away, but it's not. It's actually bringing them to the cult. But he died in 1977. Frederick Franz succeeded him as corporation president, born in 1893. Actually, you can see he's a little older than Knorr, interestingly enough. Knorr was actually born in the 1900s. But born in 1893, baptized as a Bible student in late 1913, although he says 1914. I've never understood that. Don't understand that. The whole time I've been trying to study this. But anyway, that's what he says. So 13 or 14. There is the guy. I'm not sure what I think of that picture. But anyway, there's the guy. And he became the next president of the Jehovah's Witnesses. He just sort of reminds me of like a Texan or something. I don't know what that is. But anyway, he was a former vice president of the society. He was considered to be the society's leading theologian at the time. There was a need to have such a guy. And I want you to think about it. An old guy, a theologian, a guy well-versed in the doctrine, coming in 1977, a person might say, well, what's the deal with 1977? We may not really think back to 1977, think in terms of this. But there was a real crisis going on as about the time that Knorr died and about the time that Franz took over the presidency. And it's not surprising. You'd want an old guy, a leading theologian, and a guy that had been a principal figure in the preparation of the New World Translation. So they elected actually an older guy. So he's old when he takes the office, obviously, in his 80s. He was, in fact, the oldest person to lead the society to this point. And in fact, as is noted in the encyclopedias, he was one of the oldest to ever head any religion, because he will serve until he's 99 years old. So he's in there for a while. Following his death, and let me, again, get ahead a little bit, and I'm going to come back to that crucial time in the 70s. But following his death, the society gave up the practice of restricting governing board membership to members of the so-called anointed remnant. Essentially, you're talking about people baptized before 1935, and for a very good practical reason. The ones that are left are all getting really old, and there just aren't going to be any of those anymore. So they gave it up once it was important doctrine. This guy was known for this. He didn't stay home very much. So he really doesn't get the Jehovah's Witnesses in a lot of trouble in America, because he seemed to be always gone. He was traveling around the world addressing large audiences. I wondered, Ed Jr., I wondered if you remembered, I got to thinking about you when I was preparing this, because he presented a lecture at a joint session of people filling the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium in 1950. Would you remember that as a boy? He addressed, if you can believe it, nearly 250,000 people crammed into those two baseball stadiums. That's the kind of thing that he did. And he's said to have been able to recite long passages of the Bible without notes. So, again, leading theologian, that's what the guy did. That article came out in the New York Times after 2 days after he died in 1992. Not much else of note occurred during his tenure. Like I said, he stayed out of trouble. He always stayed gone. The Witnesses experienced a rather quiet time. And what I mean by that is that there are not a lot of new controversies. But if you notice what I'm going to say next, they really were continuing to grow, stabilize, and recover from 1975's non-event. Now, I haven't talked about 1975. But just understand, notable non-event that occurred in 75. Franz died in 1992 at the age of 99 and was succeeded by this guy, Milton George Henschel. And we're going to go back and talk about him and the 70s. Born in 1920, he was baptized a Jehovah's Witness minister in 1934 and became part of the Watchtower's full-time staff in 1939. So again, you can see that he's somewhat elderly at the time he takes over in his 70s. There he is. It's hard to get a good, clear picture of him, incidentally. He doesn't take a lot of pictures, or did not take a lot of pictures. He's gone now. But he became the next president of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, this is where it starts. Two things he said in an interview in 1968. And both of these things got the Jehovah's Witnesses into an embarrassing mess. The first thing had to do with another medical thing. They'd already been noted again in 1980, remember, or rather, but earlier in the 40s and following with Knorr's administration. They had come to the point of blood transfusions, and it had already been noted that the Jehovah's Witnesses were against blood transfusion. Well, Henschel carried it further. In July 1968, now notice, he's not president now, but he is a leading member of the society. He did an interview with the Detroit Free Press, and he said, as you can read for yourself, transplanting organs is really cannibalism. They abandoned that in 1980. They don't believe that any longer, but you can imagine over the next dozen years or so how they really, as that whole thing, if you remember in the 70s, people died all the time when they had a heart attack. Now there's the possibility of transplants and so forth. My uncle was one of those that died. Had he lived maybe 10 more years, he might have lived for a long time with a transplant. But they were really getting to a lot of hot water over that. But that wasn't really what got him into all the hot water. It garnered further publicity for the Witnesses, obviously bad, negative publicity because of all their medical beliefs, again, the blood transfusions. But in that same interview, Henschel said that the society had no specific date for Armageddon. People were always pressing them. A number of years had passed since the last great date had been set for Armageddon and the end of the world and all of that. So when they asked Henschel, he said, well, there's no real date, specific date for it, but this is when he said 1975 is a year to watch, and I'm quoting him from that article. He went on to talk about, and I just kind of summarized it here, but he alluded to their view that the world would be 6,000 years old. Actually, if you go to study all of this kind of thing, we know some of you have a Bible, the King James Version especially, laying around. At the top of Genesis 1 and verse 1, it may say 4004 B.C. You ever seen that? Some of you are saying, yeah. It goes all the way back to a guy in the Catholic Church by the name of Bishop Usher. And Bishop Usher determined, calculated, by going to the Bible with genealogies and so forth. Make a long story short, he calculated that the world was created in 4004 B.C., but he didn't stop there. He said the world was created in October of 4004 B.C., and if I remember my history right, 4004 B.C. on October the 23rd at 9 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, I know, you're laughing, and if you go back to the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925, that's exactly the reaction that Clarence Darrow had when William Jennings Bryan quoted him on the stand in Dayton, Tennessee. So he asked him, 9 o'clock in the morning, is that Eastern Standard Time? You know, or whatever. And so that's how ridiculous that people have gotten, of course. Well, they picked up on that. He picked up on that. So he said, you know, when we get about into the fall, October of 1975, the world is going to be, and there's some reason for getting it a little off there, I'm not going to go into all that, but the world's going to be about 6,000 years old. And so they really thought they had it right this time. The world was going to end. Now, I was in junior high school when that date rolled around, and like I told you when we started this, I can remember kids coming up to me and asking me what I was going to do on the last day before the world ended. And that all had to do with the Jehovah's Witness. And it was on the news. I can even remember us sitting down and watching the evening news and seeing some of this stuff about it. So it was quite a big thing. This came from Henschel's article, our interview. It started in 1968. And, of course, he said that Armageddon was going to be a precursor to Christ's millennial or thousand-year reign, etc. Now, the Witnesses, obviously, this is the doctrine that drives them. It is at the basis of the Jehovah's Witness movement, has always been, and I presume always will be. Without this whole doctrine of the thousand-year reign of Jesus, new heaven and new earth, millions now living will never die, and all of that kind of thing, I don't suppose that this movement would have ever done anything. That is the doctrine of the movement. And they've become known for their spectacular end-of-the-world predictions, beginning all the way back with William Miller, even before there was such a thing as Jehovah's Witnesses, all the way back with William Miller in the 1800s that we talked about. And think about, and this is just some of them. You know, I didn't want to get sickening about it, but this is just some of them, notable ones. Remember Charles Russell's prediction, 1914, the end of the Gentile times. They said the rapture was going to come in 1914, the beginning of Christ's millennial kingdom on earth. And some of you that are historians, if you're looking at that date, 1914, it probably jumps out at you, and they were sure they had it. Because World War I started, at least overseas, about that time. So they were absolutely convinced they had it right. And they added a lot of predictions to it. In fact, as the war got on, you know, it got on into it, they said by the end of World War I, they obviously didn't know when it was going to end, but it did end in 1918. There was going to be the general rapture. Armageddon, the final big battle of the world, was going to come. The end of all Christendom, the end of all Christian churches in the world was coming. The end of all earthly governments. There was going to be worldwide anarchy. You know, all of the things that you think of as the tribulation and all of that kind of thing. They were popularizing all of this. It didn't happen. 1925, remember we talked about this. That book, Millions Now Living Will Never Die. There was going to be the establishment of Christ's millennial kingdom on earth and the resurrection. Remember how he had said the resurrection of all these dead Old Testament saints, Noah and Abraham and all these guys are going to be resurrected and they were going to be in prominent positions in Christ's new kingdom. It didn't come. In 1938, it was said that Armageddon was, quote, too close for marriage or childbearing. Don't get married. Don't have any kids. Armageddon's about to come. You don't want to start a family in that environment. 1941, only months remained before Armageddon. Again, if you're looking at that and you're a student of history, what does 38 and 41 jump out at you? 38, you're talking about basically the beginning of the war in Europe. The Nazis are invading the European countries. They're sure it's going to happen now. 1941, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor. Now they're really sure it's all coming about. 1942, Armageddon is immediately before us. Didn't happen. In 1968, what about it? What about it? What about it? What about it? Well, Henschel then went, I would just say, nuts. And I'm quoting not even the beginning of all that's said at this time. But the beginning of Christ's thousand-year reign is supposed to come in the fall of 1975. I'll give you some of the kinds of quotes that were being said. Time is running out rapidly. No question about that. There's going to be a fulfillment of Bible prophecies regarding the last days, all those unfulfilled prophecies in the Bible that you read. There's only a short period of time left. And notice this, not enough time, not long enough even for young people to grow old, and they ought not even worry about pursuing their education. Don't even go to college, don't worry about it, the world's about to end. Witnesses were commended. This was the beginning of what we've seen a lot of us in our lifetime. They were commended for selling their homes and their property to, quote, finish out the rest of their days in pioneer service. Just get out there and tell the message to the world because the world is coming to an end in 1975. And for basically a seven-year period, they went wild. And people joined by the literally hundreds of thousands as they told this story. Well, millions then living watch 1975 pass without the Battle of Armageddon, without Christ's return to earth to usher in his millennial kingdom and all that host of other things. I guess all those young people got old without an education or maybe finally decided to go to school at some point. Just think about it. Nor dies. Henschel, remember, he's the one been out there, the leading theologian. Nor dies right after the failure of this great prophecy of 1975. And the church really needs a stabilizing factor, so they hire that old man to be the president and the leading theologian. As these prophecies increased, so did the embarrassment to the Jehovah's Witnesses. And still this doctrine, even with all the failures, it's amazing. The doctrine still continues to drive the movement. Milton Henschel served only 8 years. Again, he was old. The witness movement, if I can get it out, experienced a time of great restructuring. I remember they're having to deal with all of that. But a time of great restructuring. Henschel and the 6 other board members of the governing body resigned their executive position of the Corporations of Jehovah's Witnesses finally in the year 2000. And this is interesting. Now you get to a point where the Jehovah's Witness movement is going to totally, quote unquote, restructure. And interestingly enough, Henschel doesn't go out of office when he dies. He goes out of office when they all en masse resign. They don't resign over a controversy or over some, bad story or smoking gun or anything like that. They do it all amicably, agreeably, and they switch over leadership. And they form these 3 new corporations of the Jehovah's Witnesses to hopefully try to stabilize the movement and keep the kinds of things that had gotten the movement in so much trouble from happening in the future. And we can only see where that goes. It's been 10 years since that happened, and by all of their accounts, it's all running beautifully. The Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, as they're officially known, had been run by this governing body, as we talked about, of Jehovah's Witnesses. Now, religious and administrative duties would be divided, with these 3 newly formed corporations running all the U.S. operations. It's sort of a balance of power, and if you can think about it, it's a balance of power like we have, in our own government. Hopefully one keeps a check and balance on the other. Not necessarily a bad thing. Don Adams, a 50-year veteran of the organization, became president at that time in 2000 of the Watchtower Society. And 7 lower-ranking members will make up the new board. And I'm just giving a quote out of the Washington Post, but they did take those positions on the new board. Henschel stepped down from the presidency, but remained a member of the governing body, and he died in the year 2003. And then, just one more moment, if you'll bear with me, that is Mr. Adams. He is now the president of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And he's the current president. The principal corporation of the Jehovah's Witnesses is still the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania, and he is the current president. Born in 1925, joined the Witnesses in the 40s. Again, you can tell how old he is from that. Became president when Henschel resigned in 2000. And his presidency is more or less considered purely administrative. Some have likened it to, kind of like the Queen maybe in England is now. Maybe a little more power than that. He's not considered thus far to have impacted the Jehovah's Witnesses very much, as some of those past presidents did. Then, of course, as one person put it, and I thought this was a good point, it's also noted that he hasn't served that long either, so we don't know what he will eventually do. Let me summarize and then speak about where we're going with this. The Jehovah's Witnesses bounced back from the failure in 1975. Obviously so. And by any account, they're doing as good, if not better, than they've ever done before. Kingdom halls are being built all over America. The society is growing. At times they rank right there at the top for gaining membership, right together with the Mormons, right together with the Muslims. They're doing great as far as getting membership. Now, that's not to say that I support them at all. I don't. But it's important that we realize that they have a machine, and they have what attracts people. I've given smattering of doctrine, and you can see how people are fascinated with some of this stuff. And there's a lot more. And again, it is that smoothness of presentation. But if all you have is a smooth presentation of what people do not want to hear, then you don't get very far. I mean, people might might say, well, that's a good presentation, but, I don't like it. I don't want it. But they have something that attracts people. So I want to spend some time looking at that. Talking about what fascinates people, why people are drawn to such a thing. I mean, we look at it and we see all the turmoil, all the failure. Why would anybody want to be part of that? Well, they do. And obviously hundreds of thousands, even millions do. So we want to talk about some of that. It'll be a couple of weeks, but that's where we're going with it. We'll come back.